Robin Young, it's here and now. The Bush administration begins what is shaping up to be a pivotal week in U.S.-Iraq policy with another headline, the news that firebrand U.N. Ambassador John Bolton will step down. Bolton will resign when his temporary appointment expires in a few weeks. On Wednesday, the Iraq Study Group is expected to present its recommendations on changing course in Iraq. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley went on television yesterday to say the U.S. has not failed in Iraq, downplaying a leaked memo from outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld that was critical of U.S. policy in Iraq. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Dmitry Sevastopulo, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dmitry, the Bolton resignation, it wasn't too much of a surprise. He wasn't expected to win confirmation in the new Congress. So what does this resignation say to you?
The resignation simply says that they didn't have the votes in Congress to get him through. One of the surprises about the decision to renominate him for the position was it came on the day that Nancy Pelosi went into the White House, and President Bush and Nancy Pelosi talked about a spirit of cooperation. Yet the same day, the White House put up John Bolton's nomination again, knowing that they didn't have the votes to get it through. So it was quite a strange decision. Realistically, there was no way they were going to get him up there other than using some kind of parliamentary maneuver, sending him up as an acting ambassador without a salary, which would really undermine the position at a time that the UN is quite important.
Well, and it seems as if it's also getting a distraction out of the way as we head into what could be a very interesting week today, the president meeting with one of Iraq's most powerful Shiite clerics, Abdulaziz al-Hakim. We, of course, have the confirmation hearings for Defense Secretary nominee Robert Gates tomorrow. We'll have more on that in a moment. And Wednesday, the Iraq Study Group report. What's this? What's the sense in Washington of the importance of the week?
I think it's a very important week in that we will hopefully get a sense as to what the Bush administration thinks its options are for Iraq going forward. Now, while Stephen Hadley went on television over the weekend, the National Security Advisor, and said that the administration was not failing in Iraq, the Rumsfeld memo that you mentioned earlier clearly shows that things are not going well. And I think even the president himself has admitted that things are going very badly and they need to find some new kind of direction. The question is, what will that direction be? Will they give in to Democrats' demands to bring troops out of Iraq more quickly? Or, as Mr. Bush has said himself, are they still set on victory? And what exactly does victory mean at this point?
A little more on the Rumsfeld memo. There was speculation that he might have spoken to Robert McNamara, architect of the Vietnam War, prior to writing it. It might have been about trying to have perhaps a different aspect of his role at this time for when his legacy is, determined. Well, what was the meaning of that memo so late in the game?
Well, I think two things happened. First of all, it's certainly clear that the White House had asked different cabinet officials who were involved in this and intelligence officials to put forward their views on a new course in Iraq. So that was, I think, what maybe prompted it. But certainly the timing raises a lot of questions as to whether this was Secretary Rumsfeld trying to get his version of history out before other people write it. What kind of conversation he had, if any, with Mr. McNamara, I'm not sure. I can tell you that I don't think they're friends, although their wives played tennis together. So I'm not sure what advice Mr. McNamara would have given him. I don't think Mr. McNamara is, quietly, I think he's not a supporter of the war and what's been going on or of the way Mr. Rumsfeld's been handling it.
And what about the Iraq Study Group report that's coming out on Wednesday? It's been so leaked that there's question as to whether or not there's going to be anything new in it. And whether or not the recommendations will be taken up by the president, tell us about some of the groundwork that's being laid prior to Wednesday.
Well, it's interesting. The White House about a month ago said that they weren't going to outsource their Iraq foreign policy to some outside commission. Yet I think over the last few weeks there's been a movement towards them saying, well, we're going to take all of these suggestions seriously. And some people have argued that the Rumsfeld memo, while it may have served Mr. Rumsfeld's purposes, it may have also served the White House purposes in that they can look at some of the things that are written there, and when the Iraq Study Group comes out with its recommendations on Wednesday, the White House can then say, well, actually, we were considering some of these things already, so this is our initiative.
Yeah. Things like, for instance, Rumsfeld wrote about redeploying American troops to countries neighboring Iraq, things like that.
Yeah, things like that, and I mean, possibly a short-term boost in troops in Baghdad, which is something that's being mulled at the moment. They've already increased troops a little bit, but maybe a larger increase, 10 to 20,000. And it will give the White House a little bit of a momentum if they can do that. But the real question is whether the Iraq Study Group can come out with a recommendation that will actually work. I mean, a lot of people in Washington are saying most ideas that are out there have been bandied around for a long time. And the question is, will they actually make any difference on the ground?
There is one that is expected to be the sticking point, which is a recommendation that the U.S. Begin talks with Iran and Syria. Any sense of how that's going to be received?
I think Syria is unlikely to happen for the time being. There seems to be more suggestions that Iran could become a partner in conversation. And the fact that the president is going to speak to Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who's a member of the Skiri party in Iraq, but spent a long time exiled in Iran and has very close relations with the regime in Tehran, may be a sign that they're willing to have a little bit more leeway in who they're going to talk to. Again, the extent of the conversations and how serious they'll be, it's just very difficult to tell. President Bush has been adamant until now that he wouldn't talk to Syria.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, on what's shaping up as a very interesting week.
It is.
Dimitri, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, and as a part of that week, tomorrow, former CIA Director Robert Gates, President Bush's choice to replace Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense, faces confirmation hearings before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Gates' confirmation is expected, and the hearings should provide at least a glimpse into the approach he will take on Iraq. So with so much at stake there, today a closer look at Robert Gates. We have two guests to help us do that. Joining us in the studio is Art Hulnick, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University, and also a former CIA officer who worked with Robert Gates. Welcome, Art.
Thank you very much.
And we're welcoming on the phone John Prados. He's senior fellow at the National Security Archive at George Washington University and author of the new book, Safe for Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA. John, welcome to you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
And we want to start with Art. You worked at the CIA for nearly 30 years, we understand, sometimes with Robert Gates. So we want your headline first so we know where we are here. Do you think he's the right guy?
I said several times when asked that question that I think we ought to be grateful that he's willing to take on this very thankless task of being Secretary of Defense for the last 2 years of the Bush administration.
Yeah, so you say we should be grateful. John Prados, your view at the National Archives, is Gates the right man for the job?
I'm sorry, that's National Security Archives.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Affiliated with the National Archives.
Right.
On Gates, I agree. We should be grateful that he's willing to take the job, but I think the court is out on whether it's going to be a good job.
Well, let's take a look, though, at whether or not he's the man for the job first, because as you both well know, there were other times in history when it was thought he wasn't the right man for the job. Let's briefly go through the bio. He first joined the CIA in 66, left in 74 to join the National Security Council, came back in 79. But let's take a look at that first stint, 66-74, Vietnam, Nixon was president. Art Hulnick, how was Gates viewed at the CIA at that early time?
Well, one of the things that surprised us was that Bill Casey appointed Gates to become director of intelligence, even though he had never really run any of the organizations within the Directorate of Intelligence, the analysis wing of the CIA. And unfortunately, when he started off, he made a speech suggesting that our analysis was weak and flabby and needed to be boosted, and he was going to set loose a group of junkyard dogs to make sure that this got fixed. It was the wrong illusion, I think, that he made at the time. He really meant well. He wanted to be sure that the analysis was solid. He told me once that he had to go down to the White House. He had to believe in it. If we didn't believe in it, he certainly couldn't be prepared to defend it.
Was he something of a maverick in that? Because we understand that his cubicle at CIA headquarters, did you see this? It was supposed to have anti-Nixon stickers on his cubicle. And he was considered something of a maverick. Made a comment to President Nixon?
I don't.
Do you know about that comment?
Remember seeing any of that, but I do know that he was and still is somewhat conservative on the issues, but a real pragmatist. He often said that he was willing to listen to people if they could come and argue with him about some of the judgments they were making, but he was so intimidating that many of the people just were too frightened to go and talk to him.
Well, John Prados, before we move on, I really need to know, because we've heard this story and I don't know if it's true, that he went to see Nixon in the Oval Office as Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird was leaving. And Nixon pointed to Laird and said, "There goes the most devious man in the U.S. And Robert Gates reportedly said to President Nixon, some accolade considering the source, which, people would think speaks to his, being somewhat of a maverick. I don't know if you know if that story's true, but what about that sense of him?
Well, I have to say, I think that's an apocryphal story. Mm-hmm. I believe Gates was in Europe at the time, but in any case, as a sense of the man, there are a number of people, former agency employees, who believe that Gates was a very devious man. And I think that was one of the things that figured in the controversy over his nomination as director of Central Intelligence later on.
Well, let's talk about that because, and before that, hearings in 87, he rose to deputy director in 82. He was nominated to head the CIA in 87, and Iran-Contra became the impediment at that time. This is the Reagan administration's secret sale of arms to Iran. At the same time using the money from the sale to help the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. You write about some of the questions, John, that people were asking about Robert Gates at that time.
Yes, I think that the Gates nomination after Casey was destroyed, really, by Iran-Contra, and the fact that Gates couldn't show himself to be above suspicion because so many of the Iran-Contra issues had come across his desk, and at several different points, had Gates blown the whistle, the entire Iran-Contra affair would have blown. But Gates did as much as he could to go the other way and get those things off his desk.
Well, as you write, he made a big mea culpa afterwards, a big searching, you know, soul searching.
That's right.
But did that inoculate him against, you know, or does it now inoculate him against that issue?
I think more important inoculating him against that issue is the passage of time. I think that, yes, he made this mea culpa, but as director of Central Intelligence, he was very much a bridge builder, and that plays in his favor now. And it also plays in his favor that he was never actually indicted for anything out of Iran-Contra.
Although, you know, his confirmation was withdrawn in 87. He did become director in 91 later. But, all right, it looks like you want to jump in here.
I don't agree that Bob was devious at the time. It was Casey who was the devious one. Casey withheld a lot of information from all of us as he was pursuing Iran-Contra. And the fact that Bob sat in the next office doesn't mean that he was necessarily in the loop.
Well, there was another hearing in 91. Questions at that hearing as well. Did Robert Gates, as an agent, miss the collapse of the Soviet Union? Should he have known more about that? Did he politicize intelligence? Art, what do you think about those accusations?
Well, I was working in the Directorate of Intelligence at the time. I read all the same things that Bob read. Many of them in draft. I know there are people who claim that he politicized intelligence, but I don't think there's real evidence of that, if people could see what had come out at the time. I don't think we missed the collapse of the Soviet Union, although I know that's the perception. Mm-hmm. And I think Gates was right on top of it.
We are talking about Robert Gates, the president's choice to replace Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. I want to get John Pratos' opinion on, you know, some of the other questions about him. But also, let's get to Iraq. What does Robert Gates say about Iraq? How might he act at the Defense Department, given the awareness of what he did in the CIA, all of that after we take a break. And just a quick note, when we come back later in the program, the troubles in Ireland played out on a stage. We'll have that story as well. Much more ahead, here and now. Young, it's here and now, and we're back with Boston University Professor of International Relations Art Hulnick, also a former CIA staffer, John Pratos, Senior Fellow at the National Security Archives. He's the author of the book Safe for Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA. And we're talking about Robert Gates, the former CIA director nominated by President Bush to succeed Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. And I want to start with you, John, because we were just hearing from Art, who worked with Robert Gates at the CIA, that he's been perhaps unfairly tarred by some issues at the time that were maybe former CIA Director William Casey's fault as opposed to Robert Gates. But what do you think, John Pratos, about Robert Gates' overall record as head of the CIA, especially as he heads to the Defense Department, which has been accused of sort of treading on, you know, intelligence gathering ground that should belong to other agencies? So give us your thoughts on that.
I think that's a very interesting question. The whole problem of Pentagon encroachment on intelligence roles and missions has been an enduring one, and it existed, in fact, at the time that Gates was director of Central Intelligence. And he was pretty active in terms of defending CIA roles and missions. If he retains those same viewpoints today as Secretary of Defense, he may dismantle some of the things that the Rumsfeld Defense Department has done about taking over intelligence.
And
I think in that regard, by the way, it's an interesting indication that the current Undersecretary for Intelligence Issues, Stephen Cambone, has just resigned. That opens the field for Gates to dismantle some of the things that Cambone has been central in.
Cambone, who's pushed the Defense Department in that direction of intelligence gathering. But when you talked about some of the things that Gates did at CIA, I'm thinking of the memo in 1984, when Robert Gates was then Deputy Director of Intelligence. He sent a memo to then CIA Director William Casey, arguing for a tough stance on Nicaragua.
Yeah,
he said without strong action, communist fighters would turn Nicaragua into an armed Cuba-like enclave. And, you know, so some people are wondering, does he still carry perhaps that 20-year-old worldview with him?
Well, it's a different world today, and you don't have Nicaragua to whip anymore, not to mention the Soviet Union. But that kind of a hard line is something I think that's attractive in the White House today. And from what I've heard about Gates's position on Iraq, I think that the White House is going to trust him to move forward in Iraq in more or less the current fashion.
Well, Art Holnick, who worked with Robert Gates at the CIA, what do you think the part of him that is a CIA man, how do you think that will play out at the Defense Department?
Well, I think the resignation of Dr. Cambone is a good sign that a more pragmatic approach is going to be taken. People forget that in his last tour as Director of Central Intelligence, Bob started a whole series of reform investigations at the agency, something like 20 different committees, all looking at issues that he had hoped that he could either fix or at least leave some good advice for his successor. I think the same thing is going to happen at the Pentagon. I think Bob is going to start looking at a whole series of issues, not just the Iraq war, to see what ought to be done in terms of military reform.
But yet this is someone who has not been in the military world. Well, how do you think he's going to view, for instance, outgoing Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's idea of a leaner, meaner defense machine? I mean, that complete conversion of the military.
I think Bob's going to ask the generals what they think. And I should point out, by the way, that he did serve in the U.S. Air Force for 15 months before he came to the agency. So, and all of us worked with the Pentagon throughout our careers. I know Bob did, and so did I. So the idea that we're ignorant of what goes on in what people call the five-sided puzzle palace is not the case.
The Pentagon. John Prados, your thoughts again, sticking with Iraq, what has Bob Gates said so far that gives us some indication of how he might? He's been, you know, cagey, appropriately so, in some of his comments, but he did serve on the Iraq study group until he was nominated by President Bush. So what has he said or indicated about what he's thinking about Iraq?
I think the most interesting things that he's indicated about Iraq are that he has some doubts about the pre-war planning that was done for Iraq, that he wants to resuscitate Pentagon capabilities for nation building, which was one of the ways that the U.S. occupation of Iraq went awry, but that he doesn't have any particular quarrel with the way that the occupation has actually continued and progressed.
Is that going to be problematic for the new Congress, for instance?
I think it will be problematic for the new Congress, which is looking for substantive change.
Yeah. And you mentioned at the top something I just want to touch on in the couple minutes we have, that perhaps it's not the man that should be looked at, but the job. I'm paraphrasing. And, you know, there are only a couple of years left in the current Bush administration. Perhaps change on the horizon, perhaps not. Will Robert Gates, if confirmed as assumed, be more about implementing change right now or in the future?
I think Gates is a good agent of change. At the CIA now, it happens that most of the change that occurred actually took place after Gates's watch, but it was sort of catalyzed by a number of things that Gates did. If he can perform a similar kind of catalytic role at the Pentagon, that would be in our interest.
And Art Holnick, last question for you. Again, you worked with the man. Many are saying that he will bring more of a change of style rather than perspective to the Pentagon. And can you think of what that style might be? Can you think of what that means?
Well, I think Bob will welcome ideas from all over the place and not just from the generals. One of the things that we knew at CIA was that anybody could walk into his office and talk to him, not just the senior people, but anybody who had a good idea. I think he'll play it the same way at the Pentagon.
Yes, but will he be as quotable as Donald Rumsfeld?
That I doubt. Bob tends to be much more close-mouthed than Mr. Rumsfeld.
He's a CIA guy. Art Hulnick, former CIA staffer himself. He's now professor of international relations at Boston University. Also, John Prattis, author of the book Safer Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA, a senior fellow at the National Security Archive. Thank you both for helping us take a look ahead at tomorrow's confirmation hearings for Robert Gates.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Researchers in Baltimore are peeling back layers of ancient history, with perhaps lessons for today, in the moldy pages of a manuscript even older than it first appeared. The manuscript is called the Archimedes Palimpsest. That's Palimpsest. Archimedes, because it contains some of the oldest copies of the Greek mathematician's work. Palimpsest, because, well, more on that in a moment. But after discovering the Archimedes and scraping away layers of a portion of the parchment, researchers also discovered the writings of Hyperides, a Greek orator from the 4th century B.C. Will Knoll is curator of manuscripts and rare books at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore, where this research is being done. He joins us from his office. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. You say Baltimore like a native.
You do. We're also joined by Judd Herman, professor of classics at Allegheny College. He specializes in Hyperides. Welcome, Judd.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And, Will, I want to start with you because we feel as if we've heard of this Palimpsest for a while. Didn't it reveal very important work of Archimedes having to do with something I don't understand that well, the theory of counting things up?
The method of mechanical theorem.
And what was that?
Well, that was just one of seven treatises in the Palimpsest, and two of them are unique to this manuscript. One of them is called the Stomachion, meaning bellyache, and we found out that it's how many ways you can recombine sections of a square and still make a square, and the answer is 17,152.
Okay, so this was exciting to you and mathematicians, but this has been years of studying this Palimpsest. Why is it taking so long to work with it?
A palimpsest is a manuscript that was originally written once, and then the text was scraped off and the leaves cut up and stacked in a corner and then written over with something else. And in this case, the Archimedes text was written over with a prayer book that we now know was finished on the 14th of April, 1229. So you can't actually see the Archimedes text very well. And someone looked at it in 1906 and did a wonderful job. But with modern technology, we can do better.
What kind of technology?
Mainly multispectral imaging. And we've been working for 8 years to finally produce images that people can actually read. And we're just reading a great deal more than we thought we could. And we found out that it's not just a palimpsest of Archimedes' writings, but the prayer book is actually made up of five palimpsests. And we're beginning to read those texts now as well.
And we want to get to some of what you're finding, but just before we do turn to Judd Herman, what does it look like, Will? Because we've been hearing about, you know, moldy pages. We understand that palimpsests were usually, you know, made on animal skins, which is why they're being, you know, peeled away.
That's
but
right.
What does it look and feel like?
It's about the size of a box of Domino sugar, a standard box of Domino sugar that you buy in the store. And it was about that size when it came to the Walters. It took us 4 years to take the book apart. Now it's in about 90 sheets, each of which is just slightly larger than a piece of paper that you would stick into a printer today in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's very ugly. It's very ugly, Robin. It's the ugliest book I've ever seen.
Because
very
it's...
Very unprepossessing.
Because it's old and moldy, or...?
It's old and moldy. It's suffered a very great deal in its life. Mainly, actually, not through the palimpsesting process, but through maltreatment in the 20th century.
Huh. Well, Judd Herman, it is a thing of beauty to you, I understand, because what is being found beneath the writings about Archimedes are writings from Hyperides.
That's
now,
right.
Let's remind ourselves, an iconic Greek orator. Tell us a little more about him.
Hyperides was a very well-respected orator in antiquity. He was famous for being a clever satirist, using a lot of good witty expressions, good characterization, some successful defenses. And his speeches did not survive from the ancient world, we had thought. We recovered about 50 pages of material between around 1850 and 1890 on papyrus from Egypt, and that's what I study, and Hyperides I know. We didn't think he ever survived into the Byzantine period at all. And these new discoveries in the palimpsests prove that he did. We've recovered 5 pages, front and back. That's a total of 10 pages printed of new Hyperides. This is material we've never seen before, and we had no reason to think existed after the Roman Empire.
Well, and what does it tell you, if you can be specific? I know there's 2 speeches in particular where he talks about battles, and I found that really fascinating, where he talked about what losing a battle might mean.
We didn't know when that speech had happened precisely. We knew it was sometime around the Battle of Chaeronea, we thought, before. What happened at Chaeronea was that Athens managed to persuade the Thebans to join with them to fight off the Macedonians under Alexander the Great, and more importantly, the leadership of his father, Philip II. And the Macedonians very badly beat the Athenians, and it really is the end of Athenian independence as a foreign power.
Which also means, you know, the end of a form of democracy, doesn't it?
It's essentially the end of the classical period. It's quite telling, I think, that the most recent history of Athens in the Hellenistic period, that is the post-classical period when Athens is not a major world power anymore, starts with this battle.
And what you found in this palimpsest is what Hyperides said about that battle. And it's really the first time we've heard the Athenian defense of the battle they lost.
That's right. He explains that the policy that led to this battle was unavoidable. The enemies of Hyperides and his partner Demosthenes might argue that we could have negotiated with the Macedonians. We could have come to terms. We didn't have to face them on the battlefield and lose 1,000 men. Hyperides, in his defense of this policy, in the immediate aftermath of this terrible defeat, the worst defeat Athens has suffered in 65 years, argues that we had no other choice, that that's what Athens has always done. It has always protected the other Greeks from foreign invaders. It's been doing that for over 150 years since the Persian Wars. It's interesting to see Hyperides looking to the past as a model to explain the present, because, of course, he doesn't know what the future holds. He doesn't know that this really is the end of Athenian independence.
The translated words that I'm reading are, "One must assign the start and the suggestion of every risk to those who make the motion." In other words, we take responsibility for doing it, but the outcome of these things is to be assigned to chance, and we can't not go to the righteous battle because there might be a chance loss. That's my sort of interpretation of it. Am I close?
That's exactly what he's arguing. Yes, it was our brilliant policy that got us into this situation, but it was chance, fate, luck, the gods that caused the defeat, and you can't blame individuals for that. As a result of this speech, the text we're getting, we can see that there was a lot of partisan bickering in the aftermath of the speech, as you might imagine. That policy was wrong. We should have never gone to war, says one side. The other side says that was the noble policy. We had to do it, whatever the cost. And
wow.
We're really able to kind of delineate how that squabbling played out in the months immediately after the battle.
Oh, and Judd Herman and Will Knoll, that sure is resonating now, isn't it? I mean, what are you both thinking? And start with you, Judd. What are you thinking as you read these words in present day?
You know, you can always look to the past as a model for the present, and that's exactly what Hyperides is doing.
I'm not sure that Donald Rumsfeld's quite as eloquent as Hyperides, but otherwise they have a few things in common, I think.
Much to think about, gentlemen, with what's being revealed from the past. That's Will Knoll, curator of manuscripts and rare books at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore. And we've also been speaking with Judd Herman, professor of classics at Allegheny College and a fellow at the National Humanities Center, about the old Archimedes palimpsest, revealing new information about the orator Hyperides as well. Gentlemen, thank you both.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
Also, a reminder, you can see images of the ugliest book that Will has ever seen, but a fabulous one as well, the Archimedes Palimpsest, on our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, even Archimedes and Hyperides would be stunned at what a new crop of mathematicians and scientists is coming up with. The national finalists in the Siemens competition in math, science, and technology researched everything from bioterrorism to NASA spacecraft. Today, the group and individual winners of the prestigious contest were announced. Dmitry Weintraub of Eugene, Oregon, won the $100,000 grand prize scholarship in the individual category for his research into an abstract new area of math called string topology. And three high school seniors from Oak Ridge, Tennessee will split the $100,000 team prize for research into developing microorganisms that can create alternative fuel. Scott Maloney is captain of the team. He joins us on the line. Scott, congratulations.
Thank you.
I have no idea what this is about. Your project is called, let's just give the title, Linking Supercomputing and Systems Biology for Efficient Bioethanol Production. What does that mean?
To begin with, alternative energy is a big issue in our society. You know, gas prices are way too expensive, and the fuel's non-renewable, so we're going to run out eventually. What we're trying to eventually do is to get a new source of alternative energy. Now, there are methods exist which can take things like corn, switchgrass, or particularly if you live in Brazil, sugarcane, and turn it into ethanol, which is a chemical similar to things like nail polish remover that you can burn in your car. And that works really well. But the problem is that right now for us in the U.S., it's not cost-effective. You can actually get gasoline cheaper than you can get ethanol. And so what we're trying to do is, part of the reason it's so expensive is that the method to make it is complex, and in particular, it's multi-step. You have to do many different things in order to get it done. What we've done is we've made, basically, we've made a tool to help biologists put all these steps into one.
And what is that? Is that the supercomputer?
Yeah, we've written a suite of computer programs that run on supercomputers, and they help biologists figure out which genetic data is most important. We had 200 megabytes of genomic data that we've got to process, which is something akin to 50 copies of War and Peace or some huge, huge amount of raw data, which is far more than any human biologist could ever hope to pour through. And so what we're trying to do is help biologists take this massive amount of data that they've collected and sift it down into maybe 10 or 20 things that look interesting to the computer, and then the biologist might say, hey, I can work something with this.
Well, now, wait a minute. You go to high school. I can see you coming up with software, but how'd you run it? Where'd you get a supercomputer?
Well, we actually have a class in our high school called Math Thesis. Now, I come from Oak Ridge High School in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. In Oak Ridge, we've got a national laboratory kind of in our backyard, which is really neat. A lot of parents and a lot of people are involved with it. And so we had a mentor out at the lab who gave us access to some of her computing resources, and that's how we ran it.
We understand that the Oak Ridge National Laboratory is going to continue your research. What might they get to from your work?
Yeah, it was actually really neat. Our preliminary results actually helped our mentor get $800,000 worth of funding. We're actually going to return there this summer to kind of help extend it. Right now what we've done is essentially we've proved that our computer program works. We've gone and we've shown that what we've programmed gives results that make sense and results that are not just pulled out of nowhere. And so now what we hope to do is come back this summer and apply it to expand what we're going to be working on and really start to get some really neat, nifty data to pass on to biologists.
Scott Maloney, again, he's captain of the team that just won a big prize for their science research, coming up with ways to create alternative fuels. We understand you're also a member of the cross-country team, editor-in-chief of the school literary magazine. You're a member of the Scholars Bowl academic team. Where are you going to go to school?
Well, my two top choices are Boston College and the University of Notre Dame.
Well, you just sent your resume out, you know, to both of them. And what do you want to study?
Well, I'm actually kind of a little bit of an aberration here. While both of my colleagues are real, real heavy into the science and math, I want to go into philosophy and theology.
Hyperides would be proud.
I'm glad.
And why? Why go into those fields?
Well, they tackle the meatiest issues that we as humans can look at. They tackle particularly what I want to go into, which is ethics, about what's right and what is wrong and how we as a society ought to conduct ourselves.
Well, Scott, you know what? Given your goals, I want you to hurry up and get through school because we could use you.
I appreciate that, ma'am. Thank you.
Scott Maloney's team from Oak Ridge, Tennessee won the Siemens $100,000 team scholarship. By the way, Scott, what are you going to do with your portion?
It's a scholarship, actually, so I just get to use it to pay for college, but it's expensive, so it will be useful.
That's right. Good luck to you, Scott.
Thank you.
Up next, a play about Northern Ireland where politics and soccer intersect. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and as it often does, the news dovetails with the arts today. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is scheduled to meet with Ireland's Prime Minister Bertie Ahern in London. The topic, Northern Ireland. It's the first time the two have met since mid-October, and they're expected to talk about how to implement the deadlocked St. Andrews Agreement, which calls for power sharing in the region, with a precise timetable leading up to elections in March. There have been bumps in the road, including allegations of an IRA spy ring in Parliament and charges that Protestant police are colluding with gangs carrying out attacks in the region. Well, the one-man show, A Night in November, looks at the so-called troubles between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland from a sports perspective. It demonstrates how a soccer game, or football as the rest of the world calls it, can begin one Protestant Northern Irishman's journey from bigotry to understanding. The play is being performed at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater here in Somerville, Massachusetts. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game and a frequent guest on Here and Now, has a heart that beats for the game of soccer as much as it does for a good story, and he found both when he went to see A Night in November.
In a small basement theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, actor Marty McGuire steps under a spotlight to present A Night in November. The stage is bare, but for a set of three steps that will shortly represent the grandstand at a soccer match. As the play opens, Kenneth Norman McAllister begins recalling a most significant journey.
That day started out like any other day starts out. You know, checking underneath the car for explosive devices. Well, no, you have to be one step ahead of these bastards. They keep advancing their technology on you. These days, they can blow you up with a device no bigger than a box of matches. But they'll not get me.
It's the autumn of 1993, and Kenneth McAllister, a Protestant resident of Belfast, Northern Ireland, is fooling himself, as his wife is about to tell him in shriveling terms he's an idiot to think he's important enough to be a target for the IRA. He's a clerk in the Dole office, for goodness sake. Henpecked, small-minded, taking what comfort he can from the fact that at least he's not a Catholic, Kenneth McAllister has been doing his wife's bidding for as long as he can recall. So it's no surprise that a few days after he starts his car without getting blown up, at her behest, he's driving his hacking, wheezing father-in-law, Ernie, to a soccer match between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland at Windsor Park Stadium in Belfast.
I don't like football, Ernie, so I hope you appreciate this. You don't like football? Jesus Christ. You're not a man at all, son. I worry about you, you know that?
You worry about me?
Marty McGuire plays the parts of Kenneth and Ernie. He also plays Kenneth's wife. In fact, McGuire plays all 26 of the play's characters, men, women, and children. And once Kenneth and Ernie reach Windsor Park Stadium, he's convincing as several thousand people attending the game, not to see soccer, but to roar for their own embattled counties and scream insults at the players representing the Republic.
No! What the hell's going on here, Ernie? Is this a football match? Or a bunch of lions waiting for the Christians? What the hell is going on here, Ernie? Oh, they've got blood in their nostrils, Kenny. Fenian blood.
At their worst on that November day 13 years ago, the supporters of the home team shouted vile things at the opposition. Trick or treat, they screamed, and Grey Steel 7, Ireland nil. A reminder of the Halloween slaughter of seven innocent people by gunmen just days before the match. Inspired by those events, Mari Jones wrote A Night in November, the play with a cast of one that tells the story of the awakening of Kenneth Norman McAllister. Genuinely frightened by his father-in-law and the bellowing bigots surrounding him, Kenneth tries to help a fan of the Irish team mouth the words to a song the supporters of Northern Ireland are singing so that the lonely Catholic fan won't be found out and beaten. That scene isn't much of a stretch for Marty McGuire, who spoke to me after a recent performance and said he'd learned tolerance early.
My mother was fantastic in keeping me on the straight and narrow, to make me very aware that there's good and bad in all, on both sides. And in Ireland, there was only two sides. It was Protestant and Catholic. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't race, it wasn't sexual persuasion, it was nothing. It was Catholic and Protestant. So she
refused to allow me to be that way.
A little later in the play, Kenneth MacAllister finds himself examining the circumstances of his own stunted life. He visits his boss, a Catholic who lives in a neighborhood wrapped in barbed wire and choked with soldiers, and finds that the man is happier in his home than Kenneth is in his own. Without giving away too much of a plot that continues to involve soccer and Kenneth MacAllister's discovery of genuine friendship once he's grown beyond prejudice, it's fair to say A Night in November manages to be at once a work of art and a moral lesson. The play first came to the attention of Marty McGuire when he was tending bar in Los Angeles. Initially, he was alarmed at the idea of playing so many parts, but eventually he decided to try out A Night in November as a reading at a Southern California pub.
The place was packed, because I've known a lot, you know, over the years, and people had seen our pub theatre, and they enjoyed it. You know, it's something very different for Los Angeles. And they came on a Friday night, $10, all-you-can-eat Irish stew, and me with a microphone and two light bulbs doing this show from the script, and it got a standing ovation. And I was like, oh my God, I think I'm onto something here.
McGuire has since performed A Night in November in New York, London, Edinburgh, and Dublin. He's also been back to Belfast, where he was happy to see that life had improved considerably since his boyhood there.
You don't get searched going into the city anymore. You don't get searched going into the stores anymore. And just coexisting in a wonderful, thriving atmosphere and environment. And I kept saying, if they had 3 weeks, a month of my childhood, they go, no, and no, there's no way we're ever going back to that. And that's the hope for the future, you know. And in the next generation, it'll hopefully be even better.
If the troubles in Ireland are less apparent these days than they were when Mari Jones wrote A Night in November, the play is no less powerful than it was a dozen years ago. Following performances, Marty McGuire has been approached by audience members who've told him the drama is less about the conflict in Ireland than it is about the human condition. Though he's happy about their appreciation, he says the greatest review he's ever received came from a woman for whom the play's particulars were especially significant.
We received a letter from a woman who said that she was dragged kicking and screaming to see the play because for 20-something years she had avoided all things Irish. Wouldn't even eat Irish butter because her husband was a British soldier who had been really very badly maimed in a bomb serving in Northern Ireland in the 70s. He lost an eye, he lost an arm. She said, but after what I stuck with it, and after a while the magic of the piece took over, but this one single man in his little insignificant existence, in his job, who was willing to take off the blinkers of bigotry. She says, as a result of your performance in the play, I have just taken the first step on the road to healing, a road I never thought I would be on. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Actor Marty McGuire. Our visit to A Night in November at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater here in Somerville, Massachusetts, was brought to us by Only a Game host and Here and Now regular Bill Littlefield. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.